With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Motorsport Magazine, for the very best of motor racing.
Well, hello everybody and welcome again to our Motorsport podcast, and thank you all for all the feedback you've given us since our last show. I really ought to start today with an apology, because I think that in our last programme we might have given the impression that some of us were not keen to see Jean Todt become the president of the FIA, and perhaps I should make it completely clear that we all are actually unanimously united in our wish for him not to become the president of the FIA, just so we clarify that point from last month's show. Anyway, a slight change of plan today. First of all, we've listened to what you say, and we're going to run for 45 minutes. And today we have a guest, and that is the former 1979 Grand Prix world champion, Jody Scheckter. So today we'll be talking, obviously, a lot to Jody, amongst other things, what he thinks about the championship so far this year. That's F1, not MotoGP, in case he rambles off the subject, which he might. What's happened to Jenson Button? Has he lost his form? Has the car lost its form? What's going on? Renault, what on earth happened there? Force India result at Spa. Can they do the same again? We'll also be talking about the fact that Alonso is apparently moving to Ferrari. Will this be a good thing, and who will be his teammate there? So those are some of the points we hope to cover, plus, of course, some questions from you, our readers. Anyway, welcome, Jody.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you for taking the time to come in. Let's start, if we may, on the championship so far this year, just to get us going. I mean, what is your take on... We started with Brawn winning every race, and suddenly they're not.
Well, it's sort of upside down, isn't it? Probably twice, really, because all the cars that were competitive last year weren't competitive this year. And probably the biggest shocker was Force India. I don't know how that happened. If it was a single-make engine, I would have thought there's something going on. But I don't understand it, really. How a team comes from the back consistently to the front. Just
I'm glad to hear you don't, because none of us do either. I must ask you about Ferrari this season. I mean, what a year. Apart from losing Felipe Massa, they just haven't really been on it. And is it a team you still have some sneaking affection for?
I suppose so. Because the people that were there when I was there aren't there. So from that point of view. But Ferrari is very special, I think, for anybody, even if they don't like it in a way. It's something special. But I know Stefan quite well, and we communicate. When Michael got the drive, or was going to get the drive, I sent him a text to say I'm a lot cheaper. And... at the last race, when Mazzini put it into the wall, I said, if you need me for Monza, I can get somebody to feed the chickens. And those were two texts I sent him, actually. That's real.
What do you think it is about Ferrari? You say they're a bit special.
I suppose the amazing thing was always for me is that Ferrari was only started when the old man was 50 years old. And it became such a famous brand with such enthusiasm behind it. That was probably the most amazing thing for me. But it's just sort of carried it on, I suppose. In a way you thought when he died it may not, but it seemed to carry on. Ferrari is special everywhere in the world.
Yeah, I mean, it's also very much a national team for Italy. I mean, it's, you know, there's not one person in Italy who doesn't support Ferrari. I mean, I haven't met any. I think that's pretty special from...
Yeah, I've always said when the difference with driving for Ferrari is you're driving for Italy, where any other team you're driving for the team, and that is the big difference. Yeah,
they've always been red, and they always will be red.
But, you know,
a different
how many green British cars are there?
A different red, yes.
It's a Marlboro red, though.
Yeah, well, it's changed. It has changed, yes, it's true.
Faded on the, yeah, from the sun.
That's right, yeah.
Well, I'm disappointed you're not going back at that price as well.
No. I was still expensive for nothing.
What, in your views, happened to our very own Jenson Button then, Jody?
Well, it's obviously he's not going well, but I always felt that the hardest part was when you were ahead and then you had to be conservative. And you had to have the balance between conservative and not being conservative. And that was the hardest, to really push fast. You've got to do that. And I think he got to that stage. Mind you, I also thought that Jensen, I always felt Jensen was a very quick, smooth driver when he's by himself and he has the right car. But in traffic, I've never thought he was one of the best. And so I think once he gets back into the field, I think that the good parts about his driving and about him don't shine. But if he's got the right car and he's in the front and he drives so smoothly, that's what happened in the first five races, more or less. I don't know if you guys agree with me.
Well, I mean, something I've noticed in the last few Grand Prix is when he's in the pack, I think everyone knows he's now got to get points, and that's what he's driving for. So at the start, everyone just swamps him. And, you know, he's always losing places at the start. I'm sure the other drivers see him on the inside, but I think, well, you know, it doesn't really matter if I turn it on him, he'll get out of the way, because he's not going to want to have a, you know, break.
Yeah, there is an element of that. I mean, in the style of driving, actually, Jensen always reminds me of Prost. This sort of silky smooth. I think perhaps Alain could be a little bit more of a fighter when he needed to be, you know, maybe than we sometimes see in Jensen. But, I mean, part of it, we were talking about, you know, whatever the hell happened at Spa. I talked to Nicky after qualifying finished and got predictably clipped response. I said, well, you know, what about Jensen? And he just said, well, it says he has no grip, but this is already bullshit because the other guy is fourth. Typical Lauda take on the situation. But I think this year, probably more than any year I can remember, how a car uses its tyres has been more critical this year than I can ever recall. And for whatever reason, people were saying last weekend, for, you know, the Force India just was making the best use of the Bridgestones, you know, that particular weekend. Yeah. And I think the difference between Jensen and Rubens is LeBron has had a problem all season long on cool days getting temperature into its fronts. And I think, Jody, I remember there was qualifying at a race of champions, I think in 76, and the weather was Arctic. I mean, it was March, and it was unusually cold, even for March in England. And nobody could get any temperature into their tyres. And eventually, you really started throwing your... It was a Tyrrell. It was, I think, the last time you drove a four-wheel drive Tyrrell. And you really threw the car about and got some temperature, and you were on pole by, I don't know, a second and a half.
Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do.
A few good points.
I do, yeah. Yeah.
No, that's absolutely correct. Yeah.
And I think now, you know, Rubens is taking the car by the scruff of the neck more than Jensen and getting temperature into his tyres, and he's, you know, at the moment, he's doing a better job. No question.
We got to say, haven't we, Jody, that taking the car by the scruff of the neck was something you did quite a lot of. You came to the notice of many people by being pretty fast but pretty wild. Did you consciously have to sort of temper that if you were ever going to become world champion?
No, I don't think you're just trying to do what you've got to do to win. And I think at the early days of my career, my style was probably a lot better than towards the end, because the tyres were tough in those times, and then you slid it and it was actually positive in that time, and quite often it was positive. And then as the tyres got more to the limit, you had to slide it less and less and less, and I suppose today it's even, you know, a lot worse. But you always try. I always try to adapt. I think if I had something I did well was adapting to anything, which was very good when you had a bad car, but it wasn't very good when you were trying to sort a car out, because whatever you did, you just drove around it and got the same result. And so I think that I felt I worked harder, because I was, although I worked hard at setting the car up, I don't think I was the best at getting the car set up.
But to become champion in 79 at Ferrari, there was a lot of work to be done, wasn't there? Because it was very much, I mean, for it wasn't a fantastic time for Ferrari by any stretch, was it?
Well, you know, I didn't know that, because I came in there and we had the first cars that we did, what the old cars for the first two races weren't very good at all. But I think Michelin tyres were a big part of why we won. The car was reliable, I finished every race. It was, I suppose, tough for me, because Gilles won the first sort of two races of the team, and I was the number one driver, so it was a bit like Lewis and
Alonso.
Yeah. And you put your head down and you just got to work harder and harder and harder and be tougher and tougher and tougher. And he was trying to win laps and not championships. That helped. And I won the championship, I suppose.
But in 80, I mean, the car was terrible in 80, wasn't it? Because the whole world had a true ground effect car, except you, except Ferrari.
It wasn't working. The tyres weren't working for some reason. And Gilles does some fairly good races. I don't think I had any good races that I remember. In fact, I didn't qualify in the second last race.
Montreal.
Yeah, and I mean, that's just quite strange, because you always thought, I felt when I was at the race meetings, I was trying as hard as I ever was. And I always felt the difference was I didn't wake up in the middle of the night and think about understeer or oversteer. And when you are really on it, that's the time you're thinking of those things. Whether that's true or not, I'm not sure, but that was my interpretation. Because I certainly at the races I was trying as hard, or I felt I was trying as hard as I ever did.
Well, you had a huge shunt at Imola, didn't you?
Yeah.
Long before you retired.
Yeah.
I mean, you were still on it.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah,
and Gilles crashed about two feet
that's
further
right.
on.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of people, some of our readers, in fact, want to ask you about you retired quite quickly, or from the outside it looked like that. Was that always your intention, or did you just suddenly think I've done enough, I've had enough?
Well, first of all, in those days, it was dangerous.
Yeah.
You know, one to two drivers got killed every year. So if you just think practically. The second thing, I suppose, a little bit of the magic went out of it, because people were getting killed. And sometimes some of the teams, you felt that wasn't certainly a worry or a priority. And I was very involved with safety, although people don't remember or forgot or whatever. I was very involved with it. And so I thought, well, it's probably time for me to get out. And I don't like getting beaten, so that was probably also a little bit of it. But I didn't have anything else to do after that. I just felt this was right. In fact, Renault offered me, approached me, I think, in Canada, mm-hmm. and felt I could write my, you know, whatever sort of money I wanted. And mm-hmm. I said, No, I just made up my mind, and I needed to go on and do something else.
I mean, the safety improvements we've seen are just indescribable, aren't they? I mean, it's tempting to. I mean, I know we've had the accident with Felipe Massa, but it's almost tempting to think that you're indestructible now.
Yeah, I mean, you just look at the records, there's no question about it. That's so much more safe than it was. And you know, in our day, you knew you were rolling the dice. I mean, it was part of it. And whilst it meant everything to you, I remember going back to East London, South Africa, and think, God, I'd rather be dead than here. But not just that motor racing meant so much to me, I think, in the earlier part of the career, that you were prepared to do that. Although when you first went in, you didn't realize it would actually happen. It happened to other people. Until I think when I saw Sevett, I was the first one on Sevett's accident. And that was the first time it hit me to say, boy, it can happen, you know.
But I mean, if you did it again, would you prefer to be racing in Formula One as it is now, with all, I mean, all the safety, but it's, you know, it's almost a different sport.
From the politics, definitely not. I don't know how I could take all the political decisions that are in the sport is just disgraceful. So I think I would have probably killed myself or somebody else because it's, there's so much for me unjust that's happened. From a technical point of view, I think I would have enjoyed it more, because the feedback you get in our day, you really didn't get any feedback. You thought if you go softer, you're going to get more grip. In reality, you didn't know what your aerodynamics were doing and things like that. So now there's a lot more data, and I think I would have enjoyed that a lot more. And of course, the safety is much, much nicer.
I mean, that's why I think... Sorry, Nigel.
No, I was, in fact, something I don't think I ever asked you was, when you retired, did you give any thought at all to staying in racing in some other capacity, or did you just want to change your world?
No, I just had to find something that I would enjoy and that would motivate me. I did a commentary in Long Beach, and it's hard to get excited. Yeah, come on. So that was sort of. Wasn't right for TV. And then I tried to organize a World Series like the IROC Series.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I spent a year doing that, and I also did the organized a couple of MotoGP races at Donington. And the for a year I tried to get this all the same drivers from around the world in a very fast saloon car. And I got halfway there, but it didn't happen.
I need to ask you a couple of questions from our readers, because obviously they don't have the chance to be here. Jim Kopf would like to know about driving the Tyrrell six-wheeler. I mean, that was a very, very interesting racing car. It was quite a brave decision to do as well, wasn't it? And he just wants to know what was it like when you... Well, I think actually when you first saw it, let alone drive it.
Brave or stupid. It was fun to drive, because you could throw it around. Whatever you could do, you could get away with it, and so that was quite fun. I didn't agree with the theory of why it should work, and actually, I got better results than I ever remember. I got results. If I look back, I got quite a lot of seconds. I think I won one race.
Yeah, you won.
And yeah, the car broke all the time.
You lost a wheel in Sweden, didn't you?
I lost
you?
A lot of wheels.
Apparently you didn't notice.
No, the team didn't notice. I noticed the wheel going off. I thought it was understeering. I looked down there and the wheel was off, and then I came in and I thought that just for fun I'd go in there, and I sat there and I said, it's understeering a little bit, and Derek Gardner was sitting there and understeer. And I think the mechanics had thought the other mechanic had taken the wheel off. So eventually I cracked up and said the wheels come off. But in Austria the suspension broke and was breaking nearly every race. It wasn't fun. That part wasn't fun, because it was dangerous, and when a car breaks you don't always get away with it.
Yeah, sure.
The thing I never understood about that car, I mean, the argument about the low frontal area and everything else, is going to be a bullet in a straight line. But, you know, the air still hit the rear wheel, didn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And
normal size.
And what was worse is when we went down to Paul Ricard to try them, and we had the old car and the new car, well, the new car, the six-wheeler, they put a narrower track on the back. Thanks very much. Okay? And I think they also did something with the wings. So. And then the braking should have been better with six wheels, which it was. If the road was absolutely flat and you were braking flat, but as soon as you went like this, a little wheel went up like this, and you had to put your brakes off because you didn't have anti-lock brakes or whatever.
So I think we come down on the side of stupid rather than brave, then, really, don't we?
I think for me it was, and in fact, that's when I started to lose, or they lost affection for me, maybe is the right word, within the team, because. Patrick was, this is fantastic, this is incredible, and I was saying, no, it's not good and it doesn't work, and so you can imagine who they wanted to listen to.
Okay, we've had so many questions for you, we have to keep moving on, I'm afraid, but Mark Williams wanted to know about winning in the Wolf. So did I, actually, but we all remember it so well, and in my view it was one of the best looking Grand Prix cars ever built. That must have been a fantastic moment, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, I think just because we were, 20 people in the team? And, yeah, I remember James Hunt saying to me, oh, I'm glad you're going that now, you're out of the way. And then we won the first race and he still threw me out of the way. And I think we put it in the front row at Long Beach.
Long Beach, yeah. Yeah. When you led virtually the whole way.
Yeah, I always felt that was one of my best races. And yeah. Then I had a flat tire on the front for the last 8 or 10 laps. And but yeah, it was a great achievement because we were the sort of, you know, very, very small team. I think Ferrari had 200 people. Mm. We had 20 people. And the car worked. Mm. It so happened that Patrick Head had done a lot of the design. And it's probably helped a lot.
You know? Oh, Monaco.
Yeah, one Monaco.
Yeah, exactly.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Yeah.
Was it one of those racing cars that was pretty much right the moment you got in it? Was it?
I'm not quite sure. I mean, we went testing in South Africa, and it seemed to be very good there. But it was hard to tell because the lap times before all the rubber gets down are very fast.
Yeah.
So you were going faster and faster and faster, and thinking you were improving the car. But I think it was good on short circuits. I think it was quite good. Yeah, it was a good car.
We mentioned Long Beach just now, and Richard asked us to ask you about Formula One racing in the United States, which is pretty much a damp squib in recent years. And yet, at Long Beach, there were good crowds. Have you got a view on why America doesn't like Formula One racing?
I'm just my own opinion. I'm not sure, but I don't think it's not because they don't like it. It's because they got a lot of other things going on, and that's not up in the front. I think, NASCAR is massive there, and that's the one that people follow. And until you get American teams and American drivers, and that starts to gain momentum, I think it'll become a bigger sport. But still, America's got a lot of other bigger sports.
Yeah.
I think we broke the spell. I mean, for years and years and years, we had the season began early in the year. We had the West Coast race at Long Beach. And then traditionally, the season ended at Watkins Glen on the East Coast. And you used to get massive crowds at both races. And I think Formula One was hugely popular in the States back then. But then Bernie found what he thought were more lucrative alternatives. And we sort of, it was a mishmash of, you know, a few years in Detroit and 3 years in Phoenix, you know, bit of this, bit of that, Dallas for 1 year. And in different parts of the country the whole time. And I think American, as Jody said, they had more to concentrate on than Formula One. I think it just gradually sort of slipped off the screen. Plus, you know, the other thing is Americans are used to overtaking. Well, they are. Like, you know, they like oval racing because they like... They like racing.
Sure.
And we don't. You try and talk to them about Formula One and strategy and everything else, and it's not really, you know, what I think a lot of them like.
I also think, I mean, I really don't, the having a single sort of engine, if you want, you can only have a 10-cylinder engine. One of the things in our time was that Ferrari had a different note to that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was really, really was a lot of character in the whole thing. And the sophistication of Formula One is, which is the part of the race, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
And that's tightened down so much that you really, yeah, it's a little flick here and a little flick there, yeah, rather than coming out with a different cylinder engine or
stuff.
And I think that's taken some of the...
Yeah,
it's
I
a bit... Nigel,
think of the Matra, for instance, sounded like nothing else on a flat 12 Ferrari sounded like nothing else. You know?
And now they all sound the same.
They do, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I've got a question here, Jody, from Mike, who says that you considered giving back your championship title once the Max Mosley scandal had emerged into the public domain. Is that true?
It wasn't with Max Mosley. It was just some of the decisions that had been made in the sport. The problem was that they probably enjoyed me giving it back more than I would have giving it back. So a little bit stupid. But no, I've disagreed with some of the decisions. It was a lot with Lewis and McLaren's just been, for me, totally terrible. Terrible, terrible.
Tell me a little bit more about that, though, because, I mean, I think we should... Is that from the point of view of just dishonesty or unsportsmanship, if you like? Is that what you're talking about, really?
No, this is my opinion. I think there were other factors going into the decisions that were sporting decisions because they didn't make any sense to me. The first one that was obvious was actually, that I thought was obvious when Alonso was penalised in Monza and in our day that would have been a toe, that would have been an advantage, and that was the first one that you thought, this is just what's, and then they got worse after that, and the one when Lewis went through those was just, he should have won the championship the year before, halfway through or three quarters way through, in my opinion.
It's exciting, isn't it, though, when Lewis first came on the scene? I mean, had you not seen him in GP2, I mean, those things don't happen very often, do they? And it kind of...
No. I mean, for me, the guy's brilliant. And he's, for me, he's the best that I've ever seen in traffic. And so I know people think, also another thing, if you lock a wheel going into the first corner, they want to disqualify you these days. I mean, you know, it's
yeah. Do you? I mean, I feel absolutely that the nanny state has just taken over. You know, the tiniest thing now is penalised, and it's difficult enough to overtake anyway.
Yeah, it's like a nursery school.
Yeah,
and.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they're just not right decisions. But he's brilliant in traffic. I mean, brilliant in traffic. And he's a brilliant... I have a lot of respect for him. A lot of respect.
Who else do you, rate at that level? People talk about Alonso being the best package, package being a popular word these days. I mean, and now we hear he's going to Ferrari. What's your take on that?
I think I would probably... have Lewis. If I had a choice of a driver, I would have Lewis first. Vettel. Probably second. I don't like the way, and I don't know the real innards of the way Alonso behaved when he was with McLaren. I just find it hard to work with somebody that did that sort of thing. But I don't know the total detail of it, so maybe I'm wrong on that. But yeah, he's a solid driver. I think he can win a championship. But the other two guys are probably more exciting and got more potential, maybe. Yeah. But you give him the right car, he's going to win a championship. There's no question about that.
Very few people have won the world championship, as we all know. And I think a lot of people listening now to this will be amazed and overjoyed to hear a world champion who's so frank, who is not afraid to speak his mind. And that tells us a lot, doesn't it, about how the sport has changed.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the problem now is, I've said this to you before, Rob, in the days when Jody was racing, if I wanted to interview anybody, I just would go up to the driver and say, can we do a tape? And they would say, yeah, sure, you know what, now or tomorrow?
Piss off,
yeah. That happened quite often. Yeah. But, I mean, now it's a whole different thing. Now you've sort of got to go through an armada of, you know, of PRs and
we'd
everything
quite
else.
Quite piss off nowadays, wouldn't we? Really?
Yeah, I mean,
at least it'd be a reaction.
But the other thing too is that, you know, half the time there's some member of the team sitting in on the interview to monitor what the guy is saying.
Sure.
And they're also taping it to make sure that, you know, you don't misquote the driver. And as a consequence, the driver is very often sort of almost like jelly, you know, I'm frightened to death to say anything. I remember once interviewing Rubens when he was at Ferrari, and I asked him something about his, you know, the sort of, how did he really get on with Michael? And I remember the PR sort of flashed Rubens a look, and Rubens came out with some politically correct answer, and then Rubens sort of gave me a look, which is to say, I can't say anything.
Mm.
He shouldn't have, though.
We finished the interview, and then I saw Rubens again a couple of hours later, and he said, "Look, I'm sorry, I couldn't answer, but what I would have said is, you know." Yeah. But they don't even joke anymore.
I mean,
I mean, you know, a guy like Webber does.
Yeah.
But Mark, I think, is the only driver in the paddock very often who's brave enough to say what the rest might think, but don't open their mouths about.
We always joke in the office how, you know, PR people are there to help you get what you want, but in Formula One, they're actually there to stop you. And it's a nightmare. You know, setting up every, you know, Formula One feature is a nightmare. Yeah, there's so many hoops you have to jump through.
Let me ask you something else about World Championships. Especially as all us Brits are talking about, you know, Jenson Button. I mean, when you went away from motor racing, you started an incredibly successful business in the USA. Now you have a very interesting and successful business in Britain. Do you think, it's not interesting or successful?
No, it's not profitable, put it that way.
Okay, but it's very interesting, and it's obviously done extremely well.
Yeah.
Everyone I talk to says how well done it is. But what I'm getting at here is, to become world champion is much more, isn't it, than about being a quick driver. Am I right? And therefore, because you've got to put together the whole year, you've got to put together a whole lot of things to become a world champion. Can you just tell me a bit about
that? Yeah, I think if you've got such a good car and you can drive fast, you could be lucky enough to win a world championship. But no, I agree with you. I think there's so much to be putting together, and certainly the guys that win it more than once, I feel that they also bring the team with them, and that's part of certainly the, like Michael, the great guys, they brought the team with them, and that was certainly a part of why they won races, because you can go down a wrong path quite easily, and your season will be messed up because you made a decision or you went or you're not pulling it in a certain way. But I remember asking a guy at IMG who do all the sports, and we're talking about the different sportsmen, and they felt that the racing drivers are the most intelligent, probably besides myself, because you've got so much complexity to do. You're not just getting in driving, you've got, it's the sorting out and the decisions you have to make, for the harder part, in fact, getting in and I always relax once I've made my last decision. Then it was sort of, okay, now I can just get in and do what I can do best.
Yeah. Is that, have you found that in the rest of your life, in the sense that, okay, you have the idea for the business, you do the business, and you apply to it what you're describing now, which is sort of having to keep a lot of things in place and make sure you're ahead of all of them at the same time. Is that?
I always say there's one secret to being successful, and that's hard work.
Okay.
And I've probably taken on the harder challenge with the farm and the processing and all that, because it's not just a farm. We do soil science, and we do mozzarellas and ice creams and beers and. And I used to joke and say, "Well, that's the challenge." All these, and now I realise what an idiot, an arrogant idiot I was, because it's there's a lot to do. You got to get the right people in place, but you know, a lot of the fundamentals I learned in racing applied to me in the business in America. But it's just, you know, you've just got to keep a goal, keep concentrating, working hard, not giving up. I think those are the sort of fundamentals, but there's a lot of other lessons you learn within that. I think Formula One, one of the lessons in my last company, and probably here, is advancing technology very quickly.
Yeah.
And that does it more quicker than any other industry in the world, even at wartime. And so that's a secret to nearly most businesses, even farming.
Yeah.
Because you're trying to develop products, even though they may be slow and they only have babies every 9 months or, and you're trying to do that, you can still, if you put those fundamentals in, you can still do it quicker than somebody else can do it. And that helped me in my last company. Mm. And it's helping me in this company.
I'm interested, what you're saying, you learn from Formula One lessons that helped you in your... What specifically? I mean, what did you take from Formula One that, for instance, helped in the company in the States?
Well, there were two things mainly there. One was preparing for an event, which you do for, and in fact, what we did, we were making a simulator to teach police and then military how to get ready for an event. And it really, the fundamentals weren't different. And actually, I was very interested in tennis, sort of towards the end of my career, and that, and they were the same sort of thing. And we learned lessons like, I used to say in the last company, was train as you're going to fight. Mm-hmm. Well, really what it is, if you play tennis, try and use the same balls on the same court and the same sort of racket and everything that you're going to go in, so there's nothing new.
Yeah.
And in a military situation, it's exactly the same, and you're trying to make it. So that was the one. And then moving technology very fast.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll give you an example. We were, one of the big weapon companies came to us and said, we want to use your simulator to help to develop this weapon. We have to develop a weapon that shoots twice as accurately and stuff like that. And we had this PhD guy, and we went and took the simulator around, and they were talking around and about it. And we would have made the decision probably in 15 minutes, maybe a half an hour, we would have worked out how we were going to do, what we're going to change tires, split of the wing and so. 3 months later, he came back with a test plan. And that's industry, and that's Formula One. So you know that if you bring out, if it's Microsoft or whatever it is, if you're out first, you win nearly always.
Yeah.
And so that's a very, very important part in industry, doing that. And the thing that's sort of interesting is Formula One, you're working at the last 1% is sort of between the front and the back grid. In industry, in a lot of industry, the last 25% you don't bother about.
Really?
See, I think that's very interesting. I think this whole business of becoming the best is very interesting. And you say there's no replacement for hard work. A lot of people thought you were hard work, actually. I think.
Yeah. Told you there was no replacement.
Did your attitude change somewhat after you'd won the championship? Because I remember you did say to me at the time, you know, you'd gone to Ferrari specifically to write, now's the time. I need to go to Ferrari. I need to, you know.
You mean once I'd won the championship?
Yeah. Now, when you'd won it, did you feel sort of, I don't know, slightly less committed or?
No, I think I'd achieved what I set out to achieve, and winning it twice didn't mean that much to me.
No.
And I think that very much so, I knew that I could win it after my first season, because we left Monza equally leading the world championship that year, and then I thought, well, I'm good enough to win it now. And then it took me all of those years to get everything else together to be able to achieve it.
Sure.
Ed, final question from you, maybe.
The problem they have with the Ferrari at the moment, obviously after, you know, Massa's accident with Luca Badu, it's so hard for me not to say look how bad you are, they put Luca Badu in the car. And it's obviously been a complete disaster. There's been rumours about Fisichella moving from Force India. There's been rumours about the Italian F3 champion. I mean, where would you go? I mean, I personally don't think you can stay with Badua.
I think it's embarrassing. I think it's such a great opportunity to look at the next layer of talent coming up. You've got some races just put in, maybe a couple of races each.
You've got Bertarelli.
I'm not sure. I don't follow the next layer down very much, but I think there's some guys that they must have been or should have been keeping their eye on to say, boy, this is experience to have. It's a great opportunity. Anyway.
I think the only thing is they might be chary about putting a real raw novice in at Monza. Because, I mean, Jesus, the pressure on that.
Sure.
If it were a young Italian, a Monza.
Can't do worse than...
Well, no, you can't do worse. No, absolutely.
You know, what can
no,
they
no,
do
no,
worse
no,
than...
I know.
But, I mean, Ferrari have never been... I mean, someone like Red Bull nowadays have this driver programme, and they've got drivers coming out of their
yeah.
ears.
You know, and Ferrari have actually been slightly caught out by
yeah.
that. No question.
They don't have anything like that, really. No. I mean, you know, they had the F3 champion.
You know, I'm bound to ask, to wonder, in light of having just been to these two races and seen Baddow, you sort of, to some degree, you are bound to ask, to wonder how much worth he has had as a test driver over these last few years, if he's that much off the pace.
Oh, great.
You know, yeah, but quite seriously.
Am I right to understand that he hasn't done testing for some years?
Only this year, because we've had a testing ban this year.
Okay.
So, in fairness, no, this summer he's not been near a car, but yeah. You know, prior to that, I mean, he tested last winter, and I mean, other than that, he used to be in a car every week, pretty much.
I agree. I sort of put it the other way. I said he must be quick enough, otherwise they wouldn't have used him.
Well,
and
no,
so, but
sure.
maybe he wasn't, and they no, were using no. him.
And so, what were they?
Very strange.
Were they learning maybe less than they should have been?
Very strange episode altogether, really. And yeah. and in fact, I would, you know, Fred, I feel rather sorry for the guy. I think, you know. If I wasn't on the pace, I wouldn't want to go out in it.
You had to feel sorry for him, but because it was, there's no other word for it. I mean, it was obviously, you know, it was humiliating.
Yeah.
And in a way, you can say this is kind of a nice thing about Ferrari, that they put him in the car, quote, you know, sentimentally as a thank you, which maybe other teams wouldn't have done. But on the other hand, Valencia should have been enough.
Yeah.
It really should.
More than enough.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we've run out of time, and I only hope that you out there have enjoyed it as much as I have, and I'm sure Nigel Roback has, and Ed Foster. And Jody, I've got to thank you for taking the time to come up from Leverstoke Place Farm and talk about motor racing. Thank you very much indeed.
Pleasure. Thanks.
We will see you again for the next motorsport podcast on Tuesday, the 6th of October, after the Japanese Grand Prix, unless, of course, we do one sooner, which we might. If you would like us to do one sooner, Nigel's looking aghast, just let us know, because, you know, we know that you like listening, we like doing it. Anyway, we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Motorsport Magazine, for the very best of motor...
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Racing.